My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our daily work at Daily Lives, and I'm sure that more people will be coming, and we'll fold them in as they come along. Welcome to the MSU Library, and we are co-sponsoring this event with the Library Colloquia series. And it's also appropriate always when we're on the fourth floor that the music library happens to be right there, and that the voice library is right down the hallway where all of these, our daily work, our daily lives brown bags, are now being recorded and archived. And you can listen to any of these on your home computer again simply by putting in the specific, like in this case, John McCutcheon. He will come up in the University Library catalog, and it has a little right in the center. It says, "Listen now." And you listen now. And the beautiful thing, that means that John McCutcheon is part of our permanent collection, can be listened to in East Lansing by students, can be listened by high school students up in Traverse City or in the UP or in Detroit, or it could be listened to within villages in Kenya or Vietnam or anywhere else if people have access to the MSU computer and the web. In the back, with Mark Noonan, are plenty of John McCutcheon things for sale. I would have you remember that the 10-pound fiddle is the reason that we're able to have John McCutcheon here. And tonight the concert is at 8 o'clock, right? 8 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Grove Street, right, in East Lansing. So,
By the
East Lansing Library. So come here.
You can talk at the library.
So come here the presentation tonight. So we are so pleased to have John McCutcheon on campus and John McCutcheon back in East Lansing. John has been an influential part of the folk scene for a long time. I first heard him in East Tennessee at some type of concert in support of Highlander Education and Research Center in East Tennessee. And it was just wonderful to hear him at that time, long ago, when I had hair. Was true then and true now is John is one of the most multi-talented, multi-faceted, multi-instrumental artists that exist. And I think that all of you are really going to enjoy hearing John McCutcheon. So please join me in welcoming John McCutcheon.
I think we're doing is this a mic check? Mic check. So I thought I would, I'd start off with a song that has nothing to do with what I'm just about to talk about, only peripherally. I was, and it was inspired by my eldest son's first day of junior high school. It was high school. And he came home with a big book. And I thought it was unusual that he would have homework on the very first day of school, especially in a new school. But far be it from me to stand in the way of educational expansion. And he was so engrossed in this book that in the middle of preparing supper, I went in and I said, "Will, what is it that they have you reading so furtively the very first day of school?" And he held up this book, and the book read, "Code of Conduct and Student Handbook." And I said, "Okay, well, good luck with that." And I went back to cooking supper and left my 14-year-old there to his lonely duty. About 10 minutes later, all of a sudden, from his chair came this uproar of hilarity, just doubled over laughing with tears rolling down his cheeks. I was curious because, remember, he's 14. This is a sound that's not coming from him a lot at that particular point in his life. So I went in and I said, "What's wrong?" And without even speaking or sitting up straight, he handed me the page that he was reading, and it was a list of clubs that he could be involved in his new school. And between gasps, he said, "The one at the bottom." And there at the bottom, it said, "Future Business Leaders of America." And I said, "So are you thinking of joining this club?" And he immediately became stone cold sober and looked at me and he said, "Dad," in that disgusted, dismissive way that teenage boys reserve only for their fathers. He said, "Dad, I'm your son. No, I'm not going to join the Future Business Leaders of America. I'm going to infiltrate them." Oh, we wanted to have a school fair. You know, the kind that they have almost anywhere. I was elected to talk to the principal just to see what she would say. She said, "It's a fine idea, but please understand, it takes experience and people and a good plan. And I really don't see how we could manage it now. Thanks for visiting. Now have a nice day." Well, I went to the class and I let them know that the principal had quite politely told us no. They asked Jesse and I to give it one more try to see if she would see us as a pair. And when we got to the office, she said, "Fine, I agreed to meet with each of you one at a time." I looked at Jesse with a grin, he looked at me, I looked at him, and then together we decided what was fair. And we said, "Thank you, no, we don't think so. We came here together as a team. What one can't do, you try again with two, 'cause you're never really lonesome as you seem." Well, she still said no, and when we went back, the whole class decided on a different track. We talked to all the rooms and grades, all the teachers and the aides, all the janitors and cooks were on our side. And when the whole school gathered on the front lawn and the principal saw what was going on, she said, "I will agree to meet a group of three to discuss this matter now. Please come inside." We said, "Thank you, no, we don't think so. We came here together as a team. What one can't do, you try again with two. And if two can't score, you come back with many more, 'cause you're never really lonesome as you seem." And she said, "Oh, oh, I just didn't know. We'll have the best darn fair you've ever seen. What one can't do, try again with two, and if two can't score, you come back with many more. If the group can act as one, you'll be surprised what can be done, because you're never really lonesome as you seem."
Thanks.
Well, I want to talk today about the whole notion of combining culture and community as a model for what has been done in the past, which hasn't been done for too damn long, and which I believe is a formula for success in the future, in both for us culturally and as an organizing tool. So being as I mostly have to stand up while I'm standing up in front of a group of people, if you don't mind, I'm going to sit down and tell you about my introduction to folk music, which is my purview. I was 11 years old. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, and it was a Tuesday in August. For those of you who trod the path I did, that meant that it was the All-Star season of the Little League season. I had worked my whole life for this moment. I was the starting catcher on our All-Star team. I had achieved my life's goal. Everything from then on was downhill. We lived on a farm about 3 or 4 miles outside of town, and it was time to go to practice for our team. And I was going to be late because I couldn't find my mother. Now, those of you who grew up in a rural community know that any 11-year-old kid can drive. You can drive a tractor. You can drive a truck, but not many of us would drive ourselves across town to Little League practice. It just was not done. So I was completely dependent upon my mother, and I was frantically looking for her all over the house. And I finally found her in the most unexpected place. She was in a room that we called the family room, which I always thought was hilarious because we never could have fit all 11 members of my family in that room at one time. And she was doing the most unexpected and most unmotherly thing. She was watching television. And I put on my best 11-year-old harumph and said, "Mom, we gotta go, I'm gonna be late." Now, those of you who have trod the path I have know that if you play organized sports and you are late or you miss a practice, you don't play in the next game. And as I said, this had been my life's goal, and I was not about to let my mother and CBS derail that. And she, without ever taking her eyes from the screen, patted the seat next to her and said, "Just come down and sit down here and watch this with me." Now, in our house, television was a controlled substance. My mother spent all her time trying to get her children not to watch television, so this was the most unexpected and most radical kind of invitation. And I sat down with a thump and acted like I wasn't interested, but I was really drawn to what is it that would make my mother watch television in the middle of the day. And what she was watching on this August afternoon of my 11th summer was the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, March on Washington. It was the very first thing in the history of the United States that was ever broadcast live on all three networks. Yes, for you young people, I did say that. All three networks. Imagine the privation. And if you wanted to switch from one network to the other, you actually had to get up out of your chair and walk through the snow to actually manually do this. It was incredible. And in the midst of all this, my mother, underneath her breath, to herself said, "Oh God, I wish I was there." And this was a horrifying revelation to me. My mother fed children and diapered babies and did laundry. She didn't go further than any of us had ever been away from home, except for my dad when he was in World War II, to sit in the middle of more people than I realized existed in the world, 250,000 people, and do what I didn't even understand what they were doing. But it made me pay attention, both to the television and to my mother, because I realized there was another person living inside that skin that I didn't know anything about. And there was something that made her reveal herself to me that was happening on television. And what I heard was preaching like I never heard on Sunday down at Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt Catholic Church. And there was music. Oh, it started with, those of you who remember, it started with Marian Anderson singing the national anthem, and there was Mahalia Jackson. And then the music got a little Class B. This guy who couldn't sing came out, but he was from Minnesota, from a town smaller than my town. And he sang a song that had the whole world in it. And then there were these three people, these two guys who looked like beatniks. And then a nice Midwestern Nordic looking blonde woman who was with them, which made them all right. And they sang a song that was question after question after question. And I recognized all this music as something that was old and yet urgent, that was timeless and completely contemporary. And from that moment on, I decided that's what I wanted to do. So fast forward 3 years to my first gig. I had been playing the guitar a total of 2 weeks when my neighbor, Jerry, who worked down at the paper mill, showed up one day and knocked on my door and asked me if I was free the following Saturday, which happened to be the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. He was in the paper mill workers union and had been charged with arranging entertainment for the Labor Day picnic, and he woke up that morning and realized that he had forgotten to do that. And every polka band that he called that morning was engaged because it was the Saturday of Labor Day weekend. And then he remembered that he had heard some fella squalling at the house next door with the windows open and figured, oh, good. Here's my out, and he's probably cheap. So he offered me a job singing for the picnic and offered me $25, which is more money than I had ever seen at one time in my 14 years. And I confessed to him that I only knew three songs. He said, that's fine. No one will be listening to you anyway, which was an important initial lesson in the music business. He said, but it's really important that you sing this one song. And he gave me a sheet with the words on it. He said, it's really easy. It's to the tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Just learn it. And when I give you the sign, you sing that song. So I got to the picnic, and he was true to his word. Nobody paid any attention to me. There were all these guys, most of whom I knew. They'd lived around the neighborhood. I'd seen them around town. I came from a small town. And they were all sitting around talking about the Packers and talking about women and drinking beer and paying absolutely no attention to me. Jerry gave me the sign. I stood up and I started singing this song, and everything at that picnic changed at that moment. All these men put down their beer and stood up, and they joined hands, something I had never seen men do before. And they raised their hands over their heads, and even the men who I knew had never opened their mouths once to sing a hymn in church or even sing their children happy birthday, we're singing this song like the saved. And I thought to myself, what in the world is going on here? What is making these people act in such an unusual way? And it was at that moment that I decided I wanted to find out what it was about this song and about the connection of these men to this song that made them do this. What I was witnessing, I realized, was the backwater of a singing union movement. A movement that began with song, dating back to Joseph Hillstrom, Joel Emanuel Hogland, which was what was on his immigration papers, a Swedish immigrant that we know today as Joe Hill. He took songs that were popular songs, Tin Pan Alley songs, hymns, and he wrote new words to them, only words that simply made more sense. And he connected them to movements in the early 20th century that whole groups of people, whether they could sing, whether they could speak English or not, could join in with. And a lot of you know these songs. He tells the story of up in the Fraser River country, where they were organizing against the Canadian Northern Railroad. And every time, and the Skid Row, which was, do y'all know what, you know what Skid Row, you know why it's called Skid Row? Because this is where the logs would come down the river and they would skid them up to the mills. And the immigrants who had settled in there to come and try to find work would set up camp. And this is where the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, the Wobblies, would come down and try to scare up a good meeting. And the way they would do this is to bring a whole bunch of them coming in and singing songs. Well, just about the time that that all these singing Wobblies came in, long would come a Salvation Army band. Now, it does not matter how loud you sing or how much you believe in what you're singing, two trumpets, a trombone, and a damn bass drum are going to drown you out every time. So what Joe Hill did is he took one of their most popular songs and he wrote new words to it. So when that Salvation Army band started up on the Sweet By and By, they could sing, long-haired preachers come out every night, trying to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Now, if you all think you're gonna sit out there on your academic impartiality and do nothing, you've come to the wrong brown bag. So all you have to do is answer one. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Oh, the Starvation Army, they pray, and they sing, and they dance, and they play, just to get all your coins on the drum. Then they'll tell you that you're on the bum. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, that's a lie. Oh, there's lots of other verses, but the last one said, working folks of all countries unite, side by side we for freedom will fight. When this world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by when you've learned how to cook and to fry. Chop some wood, 'twill do you good, and you'll eat in the sweet by and by. That's no lie. Now, what Joe Hill established for the American labor movement was a model to take songs that people, melodies that people already knew. And in the case of a song like this one, which he called The Preacher and the Slave, something that was truly satirical in that it used the words and the forms of the song itself, which made it all the funnier to the people who were singing it. And give these songs to the people in a spirit that could only truly be described as folk music, in that it is something that is commonly held, something that we all belong to, and it belongs to us. And we have permission then to customize these songs to our given situations. And it happened all over the place. There was a big change that happened in the labor movement post-World War II. When the Democratic Party came along and said, all this stuff that you guys are fighting for and you're getting at the bargaining table. I mean, some of you probably remember when there were CIO hospitals and things like health care was argued about and won at the bargaining table and through strikes and sit-downs and lockouts. The Democratic Party came along and said, don't you guys worry about all this stuff. We'll take care of it for you. Just vote for us. And 2012, all you have to turn around and look and see, well, it was really, as my friend in the labor movement in Britain says, well, you know, really in the United States, you people just have one political party, but because, of course, because it's the United States, you have two of them. But fast forward to what I saw on that August afternoon of my 11th summer. It was that whole model playing itself out in the civil rights movement. Except that it was powered by something that the early labor movement did not have, and that was the power of spirituality. The civil rights movement capitalized, and I don't mean this in a cynical way, capitalized on the duality of language that had existed in the world of slavery. Look at the biblical images that are in the songs of the civil rights movement. Let my people go. When the Israel was in Egypt's land. All the models were given heft by the fact that these songs were so much a part of culture already. These were not created songs. These were songs that ended up being modified. I shall not be moved. The power of the pronoun was shown to us in the civil rights movement. You could take a song like "I'll Be All Right Someday," which morphed at the Highlander Center that John was talking about in East Tennessee, something that was founded jointly by Miles Horton and Don West. If you don't know about the Highlander Center, you should learn about it. It's one of the most important democratic institutions in our country's history. It's where blacks and whites first met jointly and illegally to plan the civil rights movement. It's where Rosa Parks got her training. Rosa Parks was not an individual who simply said enough and refused to move. She received training on what, on how to do this and what was going to happen next. This was an organized effort. It was not the rugged individual. It was a group of people working together and having a plan. And at the Highlander Center, groups of students who were involved in the sit-in movement of the early 1960s, the lunch counter sit-in movements, had gathered there. These were all students. And culture was always an important part of the movements in at Highlander, with the firm belief at Highlander of two things. And those of you who know the work of Paulo Faure from Brazil know about popular education, that you don't just take experts and bring them in and preach at communities of people, but rather you bring other communities of people who have been through similar struggles, and you have them talk to one another and find out what worked in their community and what can maybe work in your community. There's a kind of currency of experience that experts are often not afforded by everyday people, that they will give to other people who have experienced the same thing. So that in Greensboro, North Carolina in the 1940s, striking tobacco workers had used the song "I'll Be All Right Someday," and they'd changed the words to "I Will Overcome." But it was at meetings at the Highlander Center with these students that someone got the notion, we'll change the "I" to "we," and it expands this song to something far greater than we ever imagined. And they also, because it was the early 1960s and because they were students, they sort of shifted the rhythm so it felt more like a Motown song. And all of a sudden, it caught on. And this was something that brought people together because they had faith in all the connotations of that word. And they wanted freedom, and they were also afraid. In fact, one of my favorite stories about Highlander and about this song was the night when the center was still in Monteagle, Tennessee, which is on the ridge. As you're driving from Chattanooga to Nashville, you come up on Monteagle Mountain, and that's where the school was originally founded. And the local sheriff raided Highlander one night with his deputies. They turned off the power, the outside breaker, and came in with guns and flashlights. And it was a group of white and black students, and they all started singing "We Shall Overcome," which drove the authorities crazy. And they started screaming at them to stop all the singing, which, of course, they didn't do. And one young African-American woman hiding under a table, when it was her turn to add a verse, sang, "We are not afraid. We are not afraid." And of course they were afraid. But people band together when they're afraid, with the conviction of their beliefs and the belief that they are also going to be protected by one another. And it's one of the things that has been unfortunately forgotten as social movements have progressed. Culture is that thing that pressures our history to tell the truth. And it tells us who we are, and it stakes out our territory. It's something that belongs to us, and we forget that in this age when everything that we identify as culture is stripped mined from us and shipped off to centers that can repackage it and sell our music and our stories and our plays and our history back to us, all dressed up and homogenized for the purpose of making a profit. So when we actually take control of our own culture and take these songs and claim them as our own and stake out our territory, it's something that creates these pressures that work against all these institutions, whether it be the arts industry, our schools, our jobs, and the media, that tell us that that is not important. And the whole point of it is to dumb us down and make us stupid and passive, and also to make us powerless. Because if we don't own this, if we don't claim this, if we don't demand this, then everything we understand and learn about ourselves, we get in a passive way by hearing it from other people, by watching it on a screen, by reading it only in a book that we have no input into. And if unless we are able to blend the worlds of culture and organizing, well, we're going to end up with the kind of movements we have today, which have no sense of culture and certainly no sense of humor. I mean, how many of you have been to a demonstration or a rally recently where it's endless speeches? I was playing at the AFL-CIO convention a number of years ago when Lane Kirkland, the president of the AFL-CIO, came up and said, "Okay, John, we're going to have a cigarette break now, so why don't you go out and sing some songs?" And I said, "I tell you what, I'll wait until they come back, and then I'll sing some songs." Because we get seduced into thinking that information and data are the things that are actually going to change the society. And it's not that. That's part of it. In much the mirror image of that is the people come up to me and say, or the bumper stickers I see that say, "Music will change the world." And that's not true. People change the world. Music is one of many things that, working in concert with economics and history and philosophy, are going to change people, and people then change the world. But without that element, we have no way of reflecting on all the information that we're giving. People, I firmly believe that people will go further on what they feel than on what they know. If you think that those students who sat down at the counters in Greensboro and in Nashville believed in what they did from a purely intellectual standpoint, they never would have. You know, everything in their history and in their fight or flight mechanism would say, "Get the hell out of here. This is stupid. This is not going to work." But when those students refused to stop singing, they employed one of the greatest weapons that the civil rights movement presented to us, is that you fight the man with weapons he doesn't understand. And the minute you take up a gun, he is going to kill you, because that's his weapon. Information and data, if that's all you're using, the man has more information and data than you do. And he can spin that to make you believe that corporations are people too. So let me add my little counterweight to the current notion that we have no sense of humor in modern movements. Now people gather around me, listen up and listen well. though the song I'm gonna sing you has nothing really very new to tell. See, all throughout the ages, without sorrow or pretense, the few have gotten wealthy at everyone's expense. For instance, just a few years back, in the mortgage field, let's take the lowest risk and get the highest yield. Bundle up those lies, sell them off to the highest bidder, and then you act so surprised when it all hits the shitter. It's a great big mess, yes, you know it's true. What in the world are folks supposed to do? I know, let's blame the teachers. They're easy prey, and they're used to taking crap every day. It's the same old story, and it's an age-old game. They get the bailouts, we get the blame. Like pimps and pushers, they sold off loans that cost folks jobs and that cost their homes. When the jig was up and when the note came due, they said, who, me? Oh no, it was you know who. Let's blame the unions, it must be them, all those greedy cops and librarians, the ones who pay all the taxes while you seek relief. Tell me who is the victim and who's the thief. Tell me where are the ones who've had enough, who hear all the lies and call their bluff. Where is the justice? Where is the shame? I'm sick and tired, I'm naming names. I blame the big banks and all the Wall Street hacks who built their fortunes upon our backs. They're too small to fess up, they're too big to fail. They're in the money, they should be in jail. 'Cause it ain't the teachers, the firemen or the cops, it's not the public workers. This stuff has gotta stop. See, it's a Robin Hood story, except the ending's skewed. All the crooks get rich, and we get screwed. One of the things that music is really able to do, especially in this age of the 15-minute news cycle, is keep alive stories that are worth hearing more than once, and worth hearing in ways that the people without access to the news cycle can actually hear. So many stories that are not never make it passed page 37. Or are never reported at all. This year is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Woody Guthrie. And Woody was the fellow who taught me how to play the guitar. Our library had a little tattered black and white paperback book, the only folk song thing in our library, and it was called Woody Guthrie Folk Songs. I had no idea who Woody Guthrie was at age 14. All I knew was that page one had a little page of chord grids that showed me how to play guitar chords. And then the songs had little chord grids above the places where you, well, those of you who know such things know what I'm talking about. And it was set up alphabetically. And because the title of this song is a number, rather than a letter, this was the very first song in the book. And I thought, being as we're here in Michigan, I would sing you this story from your state's history. Take a trip with me in 1913. Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. I'll take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners was a-having a big Christmas ball. I'll take you through a door and up a high stair. Singing and dancing is there everywhere. I'll let you shake hands with all the people you'll see. Watch the kids dance round the big Christmas tree. Oh, there's talking and laughing, and there's songs in the air. Spirit of Christmas is there everywhere. Before you know it, you're friends with us all, and you're dancing around and around in the hall. Oh, you ask about work and you ask about pay. They'll tell you that they make less than a dollar a day. Working in the copper claims and risking their lives. So it's fun to spend Christmas with their children and wives. Oh, a little girl sits down beneath the Christmas tree lights. They play the piano, so you gotta keep quiet. To see all its fun, you would not realize that the copper boss gun thugs was milling outside. One copper boss thug stuck his head in the door, laughs and he screams and he yells, there's a fire. Oh, lady hollers, there ain't no such a thing. Go on with your party, ain't no such a thing. Some people ran, but it was only a few. She says it's only the scabs and the thugs fooling you. A man grabbed his daughter and he carried her down, but the thugs held the door and he could not get out. More people ran, about 100 more. Most everybody remained on the floor. Outside, the scabs left with a murderous roar, while the children were smothered on the stairs by the door. Such a terrible sight I never did see. So we carried our children back up to their tree. Outside, the scabs left at their murderous spree. And the children that died were 73. Oh, the piano played a slow funeral tune. The town was lit up by a cold Christmas moon. Parents, they cried, and all the miners, they moaned, saying, see what your greed for money has done. Take a trip with me to 1913. Calumet, Michigan, in the copper country. Take you to a place called Italian Hall, where the miners was a
we're having the big Christmas ball.
One of the great things about songs is they can take things that are not simply historical. Now, those of you who did your math could tell that if this was 1913 and this is the centenary of Woody Guthrie's birth, he would have been 1 year old when he wrote that song. He actually got the information of the song by from reading the autobiography of the woman who was referred to in the song as saying, you know, this is only the thugs and the scabs fooling you. She was one of the labor leaders up there in Calumet. I want to give you a couple of quick examples, and then I do want to, you know, spend the last 10, 15 minutes open this whole thing up to questions and dialogue of one thing that I... that's so important in 45 years of watching this whole process and trying to figure out how it works, is what I call people who have their cultural currency, and this is what they bring to their lives and to their communities. The first is a friend of mine named Kameli Nyoma. Kameli is a Maasai. He's from Kenya, which is apparently, according to John, where some people are going to access things in the permanent collection here. He was a young man who was fatherless and had no standing in his tribe. To the Maasai, the cow is life, and it's also how you judge your wealth. Kameli had exactly one cow, and by all Maasai standards, he was impoverished by that solely having one cow. But he was thirsty to learn, and the tribe recognized this early on and sent him to America to go to medical school at the cost of 6 whole cows. And he was going to come back and be the doctor in their village, or actually for their tribe, because they are now nomadic. The Maasai, as those of you who know your African history, were great warriors and are these days nomadic cattle herders. He happened to be at an event at the United Nations on September 11th, 2001. And as with all of us, his life was changed that day. The following holiday season, nearly 3-4 months later, he went home and his tribal gathered around him and said, "Do you have any stories to tell us of what you have seen in America?" And he says, "Oh, I have one story that I must tell you." And as his tribe gathered under the acacia tree, which is the sacred tree for his tribe, and telling all the stories, he told them things that they could not believe: buildings so tall they could touch the sky, fire so hot it could melt steel, and 3,000 people in one place who died in a single morning, more people than were in his tribe. And their response to this is, "What can we do for the poor people of this country?" So the following day, a cable was sent to the American Embassy in Nairobi summoning the ambassador for a special ceremony. And the ambassador arrived and was presented with, from the Maasai to the people of America, 14 cows, with the declaration that there are no people so big that they cannot be harmed, and there are no people so small that they cannot offer comfort. Someone I never met was a woman named Sue Ann Big Crow. Sue Ann was the most storied athlete ever to come out of the Pine Ridge Reservation. If Pine Ridge sounds familiar, it's because that's where Wounded Knee happened. Sue Ann was a standout at every sport, but her dream was to lead her high school basketball team to the state championship in the state of South Dakota, thereby making it the very first Native American team to ever get a state championship in any sport in any state. In 1991, her senior year, she scored the winning basket as time ran out in the state championship game, thus fulfilling her dream. Now, most people would think that that would be the zenith of one's athletic career. But I contend that her greatest moment on the basketball court happened 3 years earlier when she was a freshman. I am Sue Ann Big Crow. I am 14 years old here on the Pine Ridge Reservation. I play for the Lady Thorpes, but that night on the court, I was the Oglala Nation. I was prepared for this moment before I was born by Chief Big Crow of Sans Arc Lakota. I am of his line, but the moment was mine the night we played in Leeds, South Dakota. I was the first one through the door, the first one on the floor. The lead fans exploded like bombs. The fake Indian war whoops, the curses, the shouts and hoots. I felt my racing heart grow still and calm. The ball fell from my hands as I faced the seething stands, my warm-up jacket draped across my shoulders. I danced the shawl dance, I sang the sacred chants, and in their silence I felt ages older. And I danced, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this real? We have danced this for these countless years. Before you left Europe, before Wounded Knee, before the long trail of tears. Ideal, but nothing here is real until someone ventures an act. For all and for free, until we finally see if freedom is fiction or fact. I am Sue Ann Big Crow, I am 14 years old, here on the Pine Ridge Reservation. I play for the Lady Thorpes, but that night on the court, I was the Oglala Nation. I play for the Lady Thorpes, but that night on the court, I was the Oglala Nation. Piece of this trilogy is actually is reflected in a song I wrote, but I don't have time to do it and play one last thing on the dulcimer before we open it up to Q&A. So I will simply tell you the story, and this is another friend of mine, a fellow by the name of Vedran Smilovic. Vedran was the principal cellist in the Sarajevo Opera Orchestra. During a rehearsal one day, and the rehearsal hall was located in a place called Vaseminske. There was a mortar attack on the last operating bakery of Sarajevo in May of 1992. 22 people standing in a bread line were killed. The following day, precisely at the hour of the attack, Vedran shows up, skipping his rehearsal, in full tux and tails, clambers over the rubble created by the attack, and sets up a wooden chair, a folding chair, in the middle of the crater that was created by the mortar, takes out his cello and plays Albanino's Adagio in G minor. which is not only one of the most heartbreakingly beautiful pieces of music, it was also the lone piece of music that survived the firebombing of the National Museum in Dresden. No accident that he chose that piece of music. And he chose it as it survived the firebombing as an incomplete. Those of you who know Albinino's Adagio may not know that it was actually completed by an Albinino scholar. It was left as an incomplete piece, and that's how he performed it. When he was done, he played that one piece, he packed up, left, only to show up the following day precisely at the hour of the attack to play the same piece of music in the same place again. And he did this for 22 straight days, one for every person killed in that attack, one for every family without a loved one and without bread. To me, all these stories, Kameli Nyoma, Sue Ann Big Crow, Vedran Smilovich, are tied together by that notion of cultural currency. This is what I have of value. In Naomi's, Kameli Nyoma's case, he gave his one cow. He said, this is what I have to do something. I will give the only thing I have that is worth anything. And the tribe responded by adding 13 cows. For those of you who are interested in what happened to those 13 cows, a little sidebar. At the end of the ceremony, the ambassador got back into his Land Rover and was about to leave when they said, excuse me, you forgot your cows. And he said to Kameli, well, what am I supposed to do with these cows? And he says, well, I don't know. Take them to America. He said, well, how can we take them to America? And Kameli's response is, well, if you can move 350,000 troops to Iraq, you can probably figure out how to get 14 cows to the United States. So what they agreed to do is the United States entrusted the oversight to the tribe, and these cows are sacred now. They will never be slaughtered, and there are now 38 cows, as is the way of cows. And Sue Ann Big Crow, who confronted the violence and the hatred leveled at her and her teammates by saying, this is who I am. This is who I am. And you can take, if you're going to make fun of it, understand what you're doing. And the backstory of that is when she was done doing that, she picked up the ball, circled it, and laid up a perfect layup to the cheers of the crowd. The lead kids beat the fighting Thorpes that night, but they became fast friends. But it was a little too much of a Hollywood ending to include in the song. And the most important part of the story, I thought, was the here's who I am. And the same thing with Vedran Smilovich. He said, to quote Leonard Bernstein, this will be our response to violence. To make music more passionately, more determinedly, and more beautifully than ever before. These were all things that these people owned. They were part of their being, and they responded to the world around them, to the ugliness, with something remarkably beautiful. And that's something that we do with our culture. It can only be taken away from us with our bidding, with our permission. I want to close with my favorite song. And a chance for y'all to hear the hammer dulcimer as well. I can't do this in my performances. So. This is what it looks like. Sort of like a big, I don't know, industrial cheese slicer. This is, you know, one of the exercises that I often do in groups like this, and we unfortunately, I talk too long and we didn't have enough time, is to ask people, and you can just think of this on your own, to think of your favorite song. And then to think about articulating why that song is your favorite song. And I'll leave that part, that explanation to you, because it is personal for everyone. But in creating the analogy with culture and organizing, information and emotion, the reason that that song is your favorite song probably has little to do with the melody. Or maybe even with the words. It might be that was the song I danced my first slow dance with my spouse to. Or it reminds me of a part of my life that is gone forever, and that's how I hold on to it. Or I learned this song from my grandmother. Or there's some kind of emotional connection that breathes life into this thing that you hold so dear. Such is the case with this song. I learned this song from a great mentor of mine. When I was a college student, I was going to a little college in northern Minnesota, St. John's University, for those of you in academia, might be familiar with it. I was starting to play the banjo, and playing the banjo in the state of Minnesota is kind of the ultimate in cultural denial. So when all my friends were going off to their junior year abroad, and I had no resources to make that happen, and I didn't even know what it was because I came from a family that had no history with college, and I realized I was going to be, you know, bereft and alone on campus while all my friends were doing fabulous things in fabulous places, I convinced my advisor to let me spend my junior year abroad in East Kentucky, where I was going to travel around and visit people who played the banjo. And I realized that my academic career had not prepared me for the kind of integrated lives that people lived. And there was not going to be someone with a nice pedagogy focusing on a stepwise instruction in how to play the banjo, but rather it was going to be, well, I'll just play something for you and see if you can make sense of it. And it was before too long, I was hanging out with fiddle players and banjo players and people who sang religious songs and people who had been a part of interesting things in regional history. And such was the case with a fellow by the name of Nimrod Workman, who was a retired coal miner, born in Martin County, Kentucky. And at the age of 12, he went to work in the coal mines of Mingo County, West Virginia, and he worked there for the next 42 years of his life. Nimrod was kind of the Forrest Gump of Appalachia, in that it seems like there were few things in his long life in the region that he was not somehow involved in. For instance, he worked with Mother Jones and with John L. Lewis to bring the United Mine Workers into the state of West Virginia. And those of you who know your history know that that was no mean feat. He fought in the Battle of Blair Mountain. Now, there might actually be some people in this room who know what the Battle of Blair Mountain was. 1921. Those of you who saw the movie Mate One, if they made the next movie, it would be the Battle of Blair Mountain. Tens of thousands of miners, armed rebellion, the very first time the United States military ever used aerial bombing was in the Battle of Blair Mountain, and Nimrod was there. Nimrod taught me this song when I was 20 years old, and he was 75. It's still the best song I know. It's kind of a standard to which I aspire. I figure if ever I could write a song like this that says everything it needs to say in four lines and then have the good sense to stop writing, I will consider myself a writer. Step by step, the longest march can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none. Step by step, the longest march can be won. Many stones
eyes can form an arch, singling on, singling, and by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singling on.
I have afforded it a whole 5 minutes, or really for as long as people want to stay around and talk. I can't imagine that you wouldn't have questions, comments, criticisms about stuff that I have said, at least inaccuracies, perhaps. Yes?
What country was your hammered dulcimer made in?
This one was made in the country of West Virginia. It's an instrument that originally comes from the Middle East, from what is today, it's historically Persia, which is Iran with some little bit of Turkey thrown in. And it was an instrument that developed about 5,000 years ago. It's a classical instrument known as a santur today. And it was the instrument, actually, if you think about it, it's one of those duh moments. This is the instrument that inspired the invention of the piano. If you look inside of a piano, you will see 88 little hammers. Prior to the 18th century, when the keyboard instrument was going through radical and rapid changes, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, the harpsichord was the dominant keyboard instrument. And those of you who know about the harpsichord know it's plucked. And no matter how hard you press a key, it's always the same volume. And so when keyboard players saw beggars on the street playing this instrument, and they could go, or they got the notion to replace the plectrums of the harpsichord with the mallets of the Iranian santur, and the piano was born.
So really, it's a percussion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's the most recent instrument that I've learned to play that I will actually play in public. And it really allowed me, when I was a fiddle player primarily when I played this, and I all of a sudden got this, and I always wanted to play the drums.
Right.
Now I can. Yes.
Hey, John, I just want to announce again that tonight you'll be at a concert in the hut. Fiddle. If I take it online, it's from 5, you can buy it on the 4 for the Unitarian Church. The box office opens at 7, the house will open at 7:30.
It'll
be at 1 o'clock. Before people have to leave, you'll be here for a while.
Yeah.
People have to leave, I just wanted to mention Unitarian Church, Grove Street, by the East Lansing Library, 8 o'clock tonight, get there by 7:30, box office opens at 7.
And it's for those of you who have never been to the 10-pound fiddle, it's one of the great folk music places and venues it's an idea. And it happens at the Unitarian Church. sometimes in other places. Sometimes, or is that your current home?
That's our main thing. And yeah. It costs too much, and we'd rather people go to you.
So yeah. And that's a great idea. So, yeah, come tonight, because I tell you, probably step by step is the only thing I have sung today that I will do tonight. It'll be completely different. I don't have banjos and fiddles and pianos and auto harps and jaw harps and body slapping. Yes.
Do you have any observations on the accuracy or inaccuracies in the 1913 massacre?
I recently picked up a book called Rebels on the Range. That I'm about halfway through. There's lots of, I mean, Woody Guthrie, we are presented with, as Americans, a pretty sanitized view of who Woody Guthrie was.
Yes.
Woody was a communist.
Yes.
And he was a committed revolutionary. Bless his little red heart. And he was not above turning history into propaganda as well. But also, I mean, if you think about it, we all do this. We look at, certainly not you academics, you look at a situation and you interpret it through the lens which has been formed by your experience, your own particular way of looking at the world. There have been lots of discussion about whether this actually happened in the way that Woody portrayed it. He got his information not from tireless scholarly research, but from rather reading this book by one of the organizers from the campaign up there. Do you have some insight on it?
Well, let me just jump in. I do research on the 1913 carpet strike, so it's one of those things where I get to jump in every once in a while. Actually, two books have been recently written. Steve Leto wrote both of them, a lawyer in Detroit. One's called Death's Door. And the other one, the newer one, the name escapes me.
Shortcut.
Mother Bloor, when she wrote We Are Many, she was an organizer from the Socialist Party at that time who was in Calumet. She was passing through, was at the Christmas party, so she was an eyewitness. But there is no proof that anyone actually barred the doors. There were questions about doors opening in or out. All Leto actually covers all this. In Shortcut, he actually gives the name of the key person that he believes actually yelled fire. Okay? So there's still a good amount of controversy about it. But bear in mind, when Woody wrote the song, We Are Many was one of the only things that was actually published at that time. So if he was being scholarly, it was one of the only things that he could have referred to in the actual writing of the song. There's a brand new movie that is coming out for the anniversary of the copper strike on 1913 Massacre, the song. It's being made by two New York filmmakers, and we'll be showing it here on campus the minute that it's available to come to the Midwest. So look for that.
You mean this one?
That one.
This one.
Right. I think it's
what popularized it, and in fact, it was the notice of it in Labor's Untold Story that made me a labor activist and everything else when I was on here as an undergraduate in the 1970s.
Well, and it could be said that many of the things that Woody wrote about would have been forgotten. The Ludlow Massacre.
But wait a second. Arlo Guthrie covered that song.
Yes, and it's
Washington County.
Right.
And it's the saddest song I've ever heard in my life.
Just recently I was on a tour in California and I woke up and I happened to realize that it was the 64th anniversary of the plane crash that inspired the song Deportees. And I was in Fresno playing the night before, and I woke up and realized that everybody thinks Los Gatos Canyon is down near San Jose, and actually it was Los Gatos Creek Canyon in western Fresno County. And I went out there to visit the site thinking, you gotta do it. And not a single neighbor had even heard of the plane crash. And Woody wrote about it. It was a lot of Guthrie scholars think it was his last great song. He was by that time pretty much completely incapacitated by Huntington's chorea. And this happened in January 28th, 1948. He read about it in the New York Times, which was picked up as a trailer from the Kalinga Times, which is near where the crash site was. And the thing that prompted him to write this was the fact that there were, 35 people on board, seven of which were crew members and 28 were Mexican nationals being ferried to a detention center in Southern California because their work contracts were out in the Bracero program. And the seven crew members were scrupulously named their ages, their hometowns, where they lived, and then the article closed with, and there were 28 Mexican nationals also on board. And what he reacted to, and people think it's a song about immigration, it's actually a song about anonymity. And that was, it was, and he actually never put, the melody that is familiarized to that song was written by a school teacher 10 years later named Martin Hoffman. And what Woody, the one time that Woody ever performed it, he sort of chanted it without a melody. It was more a poem than anything else. But it's safe to say that these are three examples of how songs are often the only avenue into knowledge of any of these events. And these form, if you think about as working people, and if you have a job, you are a working person. This is our history. And who else is going to tell it? I remember meeting a fellow who was building the Sydney Opera House, and I wish I had time to sing that song for you. A fellow who came up to me and related my first tour of Australia, how he wanted to hear the song I Dreamed I Saw Joe Hill last night, because the last person he had seen sing that song in person was Paul Robeson in 1960 during his lone concert tour. And he had gone to the site of the Sydney Opera House and done a concert for the workers. So he could say he was the first person to do a concert at the Sydney Opera House. And he talked to the workers saying, when you are done here, when the last nail is driven, when the last coat of paint is dry, your work is not done. You have to go home and you have to tell your children what you have done here, so that they never forget. And you have to tell them over and over until they beg you to stop. Because then they will tell their children and their children after them, because those kids are going to go to school and they're going to learn that the Sydney Opera House was built by architects and by financiers and by prime ministers, and that is a lie. And you have to tell them who built this building and who built this world, because no one else is going to tell them. And he was a man who understood the importance of claiming the heritage. And one of the ways we do this is by telling our stories and singing our songs and claiming our own history, so that it is not co-opted by those people who think, who can put out that what we do and are and what belongs to us is not important. And that's what this is all about. That's what these songs are about. That's what these stories are about. That's what organizing with culture as a primary component of your organizing is about. You had a question? No? No more? Yes?
There's a new theme that I visited once, I think it's written about the copper industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells the story entirely from the point of view of the mine owners. And so I asked one of the docents of the museum, how come? They said, because they put up the money for the museum.
Well, to the victor goes the spoils and the history. And that's what I was referring to when I said our culture forces our history to tell the truth, because it makes us question those official, you know. One note I made to myself I was driving here today was a memory I had of visiting Auschwitz in 1991, and there was a display of poetry written by inmates. And it was poetry that was nothing like what I expected. It was poetry of, it talked of love and resistance and of hope. And it gave humanity to people who you have these stereotypical images of sheep lining up going into the gas chambers. And it that made me want to find out more about this. And this is what it can do. It can pick our curiosity and demand that we are told the truth. Anything else?
I'd just say that would we please give John another round of applause? He's got stuff for sale.
Thanks.